put it down for me? Would you throw your pride away just to have some pride today?
Right where you belong. This is CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
Coming from the University of Winnipeg, Centennial Hall, fourth and a half floor, sandwiched between the toxic smell of microwaved popcorn toppings and the sound of flushing toilets, you have reached the windowless paradise that is CKUW 95.9 FM. Listener-driven radio with a little something for everyone.
The first segment of our show is a post-dated interview, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Mad Abu Ghazala will be telling us about Daily Hugs. So if you could introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about Daily Hugs, that'd be great.
Sure. So I was actually born in Palestine and grew up in Saudi Arabia and then came to the U.S., for college. So I have a computer science degree and a law degree, and I did the corporate thing for a few years, for like 20 years, and then I had a small business. I sold it and decided I wanted to do something more meaningful. So I went back to Palestine and tried to see what I could do to invest there. And that's when I came up, based on the needs that I saw there, I thought what they really needed was like some place they could escape from the situation they're in. Because as you know, it's and people now are far more aware of it than they were. This was back in 2012. It's a pretty harsh situation. So I wanted people to see, have this little bubble where they could try to experience some joy in their life. And that's I've been doing that since 2012.
So I'd imagine that a lot of people come in with mental health concerns or stresses over a situation.
Well, it's universal. PTSD, especially in children, is everybody has it there. Virtually everyone has seen violence firsthand. They've seen their father abused, probably. They've had people they've known been arrested and put in prison. So all of that has impact. And as you can imagine, people, kids on the spectrum, it would impact them even more so than anyone else. So, you know, everything is just extremely difficult, and it's a really hard situation. So it was something I thought that was really needed.
So how do you provide support for those on the spectrum with PTSD or experiencing the aftershock of the whole situation?
Right. So just as a backdrop, I have zero clinical experience or any real knowledge about that, other than I dealt with it a little bit in the U.S., but just peripherally. And this is how, when you're dealing in a situation where there's such dramatic needs, you can't go in there thinking, how do I solve this problem? Or you're not going to get started. You have to go in there and say, what is it that I can do to help? Is there anything I can do to help? And so rather than say, okay, well, here's some vast research I've read, and this is how we're going to approach this problem, which would have been nice if I could afford to do that, or had the background to do that, I just said, what works? And what I found worked the most was when they interacted with animals. Because this I had read about. I had read that there's equine therapy or equine therapy that I knew that would help. So we had 15 rescued donkeys that were severely abused. I mean, unimaginably abused. I mean, virtually all donkeys are abused there because they're labor animals, so they're beaten regularly. That's how they get them to do their work. And so when we brought some of these kids in, and I predominantly dealt with kids on the spectrum, they had this natural affinity to these to the abused donkeys. We had one that was he had an eye that was poked out. It was that bad. Or it was just beaten so hard on his eye that he lost it. And he still had this really positive demeanor about him, and this dignity and self-respect about him, and was still very loving. Even though he did have some trust issues, he still cared about people. And so when the kids interact with others, and I consider animals others, that have gone through hardship and come out of it, I mean, there's a connection that is made that I didn't see that connection being made to other humans. I don't know, they just feel maybe that their guard's a little bit down more with these animals. So to answer your question, is the way I addressed it was just intuitively, just seeing what worked.
So in your time doing this work, especially with those on the spectrum, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you?
There is one. So we had a both success and failure. It shows both sides. So we had a group come in. These were kids with special needs from a refugee camp, a really poor refugee camp where their people didn't really even have furniture. It was that bad. And so everybody was under stress. You can imagine their teachers were under stress. And there's one boy that they said they couldn't ever control, and they were worried about this. The sanctuary is about an acre out of, it's like an olive orchard where there's some stadium was built into it. I don't know if you can have a link that might show some pictures of it. But it's an outdoors rural area. And so the teachers came with about maybe 30 kids and about 5 teachers or supervisors. I'm not exactly sure what their position was. So they said, well, you know, we don't have any agenda. We just basically they just wanted to get the kids out of the confined area they were living in. So they didn't really care what happened, just as long as they're outside. And so they said, but watch out for this one child, this one boy, because he's very, quote, as they used the term, they said he was really unruly and hard to control. And so when he came to the sanctuary, he started wandering off, and the supervisors literally just started yelling at him. I mean, very abusive. And I realized that's how these interactions go, that they, in their hearts, you know, they haven't been trained. They, in their hearts, want to help these kids, but they haven't been taught a good way to communicate with them. So the only way they know how to deal with them was to yell at them, which just made every behavior worse. And so that's what they were doing with this boy. Was they were he started to wander off because he was enjoying himself. He saw the grass and the trees, and we have about 40 dogs, and he just wanted to explore. And they kept yelling at him, and it wasn't registering with them what was wrong. And so we fed the teachers, so got them out of the way, and the boy this time wandered off, and nobody noticed. And all he did was he had this we had one all of our dogs were feral dogs. Rescued from the streets that were either hit by cars, like a lot of them were tripods, three-legged, because they I got hit by a car and had to have a leg amputated. Or that we got them as puppies that were abandoned. So they all had, like, severe trauma in their life. But they were all just so happy and grateful. I mean, to a T, all of them were. And so he stumbled onto one dog that was a German Shepherd. That he was the one exception to that. He was the only non-feral dog that we had, and we got him because his owner passed away, or his caretaker passed away. So he was left pretty much to fend for himself, and we got him. Other than that, all the dogs were picked up from the street. And and this dog was also so grateful to have its second chance in life. And so the two of them just really bonded, and he was calm. The child just sat there, and he just existed, just was present with the German Shepherd. And the German Shepherd reciprocated. He just sat with them really patiently, and they just spent time together. And it just, to me, it was such a powerful lesson that if you, from the outside, if you just saw this up until that point, you'd say, boy, this boy has real problems. And, you know, they're yelling at him, and he's not even responding. And we don't know what's going on with him. And that, you just fast forward a few minutes, and you see he's a really loving child. He's just never been given a real chance to show that.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. In this segment of our show, Kathleen Miller will be telling us a little bit about South Nation Archery. So what can you tell me about your adapted archery work?
In terms of coaching in the sport of archery, we're taught right from the beginning the history of adapted sports and how archery was one of the first sports to be adapted for what started out as the Stoke Mandeville Games, but what became the Paralympic Games. So as a coach, you're supposed to be able to look at what the person can do, and if the equipment is not suitable for those physical or emotional or mental challenges, you should be able to adapt the equipment in order to make that successful for the individual. So that's a problem-solving nature of what we do in archery anyway.
So what are some of the most common adaptations?
Anywhere the hands touch. Now, if we have withered limbs, if we have spasticity, there may be some things where we adapt for the limb itself, but I would say the majority of what we have to do is in the hands, how when the hands touch the bow and how we hook up on the string. And sometimes the fingers can't be used on the string. Sometimes if we're missing an entire limb, then we have to actually have a special jacket or vest kind of looking device that allows the person to hook up using their shoulders. In severe cases, people shoot with their teeth and their and push the bow away with their feet if we have both arms missing. But in general, I would say it's mainly in where the hands touch the bow itself and the string.
So what are some of the benefits for an archer with a disability to actually be able to participate in the sport?
Well, the mental side of the sport is really significant for overall health. There's a certain amount of discipline for all people in taking archery because it is you with the equipment, and there's a certain amount of satisfaction in what can be accomplished. So when someone's had some setbacks or they've had things from birth that have been challenges, by allowing that person to find the adapted equipment and join in to an activity, there is the discipline of shooting, the challenge that is within your control, which is different from a team sport. So you and the equipment and the target are a team, and you, everyone starts at their own level of ability, and then I work towards the best competency I can achieve. And if you have a good coach, then you really progress with what the equipment is going to be able to do for you, but you're working with the equipment. So for some people, that it may be the first time in their life that they really feel that they're in control of the activity and feel independent, because that's another thing that you need to work on as coach, is to make sure that the athlete can be, or the participant in a recreational setting, can do everything themselves. So that's quite liberating for some people who have had quite a few challenges all the way through.
So in your time with the sport, has there been any success moment or story that stands out for you?
Well, I've coached to the Pan American Games level, Para Pan Am, and also to the Paralympic level. And those stories are always inspirational, for sure. And those people give others good role models of success. But my favorite story is a young boy who came to us with a withered limb. And we built him a kind of a tripod arrangement out of ABS plumbing and a padded waistband that he could actually hold the bow himself to aim at the target. And with a mechanical release, called a release aid, he was able to contact the string and draw the bow and hold it in the air himself. And that took us a fair amount of time to figure out the triangulation, how we could displace the mass weight of the bow so that the child could actually lift and maintain the bow in the air to aim and finish a shot. So we spent quite a bit of time with that child, and the look on his face when he was able to shoot the bow himself and hit the center of the target is something that you work for always as a coach.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need for inclusion in sport, what would you say?
Well, there's a trend in Canada, not so much in other countries in the world, that all activities are supposed to have an inclusive element to them. I mean, in archery, it's part of the history, especially after World War II. And we have some very, very successful athletes that can compete on an absolutely equal footing with able-bodied. So in the sport of archery, you do have the ability to be included as an equal, or you have the ability to compete with others who have similar challenges. And because there's a classification system, you're not being expected in a para event to compete against someone who has more ability to, let's say, move, or with spinal injuries, how far up the lesion is up the spine. Classification keeps it fair, and based on the classification, then we choose the equipment that's allowed and start working with the archer for what they want to do with the sport.
I thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
Andy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Disability Studies Students Association is a small and tight-knit community of people who are passionate about and committed to representing and supporting disability studies students at the University of Windsor. The DSSA holds events on campus and in the community, like the annual Down Syndrome Day Walk, to raise funds for supporting organizations. If you would like to get involved or learn more, you can contact the Disability Studies Student Association directly at dssa@uwindsor.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Ma'ad Abu Ghazala told us a little bit about Daily Hugs, and we heard about South Nation Archery from Kathleen Miller. In this segment of our show, John Aslan will be giving us an update on his wheelchair basketball program. So what's the latest with your wheelchair basketball program?
So we moved out to Essex last year. And we've been playing at the Essex Recreation Center, practicing there Monday nights now, from 7 till 10.
So, what sort of accessibility considerations were there in making the move?
A lot, actually. One of our biggest considerations was transportation. There's a lot of different service providers, but when it comes to public transit, there really isn't any options to get out of the city of Windsor to the county conveniently. So that was one of the biggest concessions that we had to consider.
So have you been working in partnership with any other organization to help make this happen?
Not exactly. We've had different sponsors over the years. Motion Specialties was a previous sponsor. Experience Home Healthcare. And Mobody was also a previous sponsor, but at this point in time, we are currently looking for some new sponsors to sign.
So, how does the organization reach out to potential players with disabilities to let them know that wheelchair basketball does exist locally?
To reach out to individuals, it's a bit of a grind. It usually comes down to when we meet people or if we happen to get involved or meet service providers or other organizations providing services to our community. And we also try to work with physiotherapists and rehabilitation programs for individuals who may have experienced some sort of a trauma or injury that they feel might be appropriate for them.
So, what are some of the key benefits for the players?
There are several benefits to wheelchair basketball or just general parasport organizations, being a part of them. One of the biggest things that I think is finding community, especially for those who may have experienced trauma recently, which has led to their having a disability. While we might all have different abilities, there's a common ground of sport that we're all participating in, and that's what everybody seems to focus on. So it helps to bring a little bit of camaraderie, and it also helps to build some confidence.
I'd imagine that's something that can be translated into other aspects of life. You find strength in the court, you can bring it home with you.
Absolutely. I mean, just speaking for myself personally, I started playing wheelchair basketball in around 2012, and before that, I was honestly really struggling. I had a hard time finding work. I was dealing with mental health issues, depression, and things like that. And when I found wheelchair basketball and started playing, in the beginning, it was really difficult. I was still struggling internally. But after a little while, I did start to build some confidence, and now it's my passion. So wheelchair basketball specifically, for myself personally, has given me some direction.
So, that being said, do you have any advice for anyone out there who might be struggling in the same way, trying to find that grounding that the parasport can offer?
Just give it a try. There's always barriers that are created. A lot of them, I feel, we create ourselves. And if we can push past those and just for the benefit of our own well-being, say yes to something and try even once, that can have a perspective-changing moment.
So in your time with wheelchair basketball, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
I guess, like, since we started playing, or since I've started playing, it was purely just recreational, something fun to do, and to find a group of people to play with. Since then, the club has become competitive, and we have a travel team. And I would say that our biggest accomplishment as a team, and for myself as the coach, would be when we participated in the Ontario Parasport Games in 2023. We saw the podium, we finished in third place.
Are there any projects on the horizon or things you'd like to see added for the upcoming year?
For the club specifically, what we're doing right now, we do have a fundraising campaign that's taking place. Our goal is to try to get a bigger trailer so that we can have access to all of our equipment with us while we're at practice. What we find is that if somebody new comes out and we don't have a chair that's equipped for them, readily available, that can be a discouraging moment. And it goes back to what I was just saying about going out and trying. For those people that are actually making that effort and trying, we want to make sure that we can provide the equipment. So yeah, one of our biggest projects right now is to get a trailer so we can have readily accessible equipment for anybody coming to our program.
So the game itself, do you use any modified rules? You mentioned some of the modified equipment, so...
Not really. So wheelchair basketball and stand-up basketball have almost identical rules. There have only been a couple of changes made to accommodate wheelchair basketball, and one of them being the double dribble rule. So in wheelchair basketball, we do not have a double dribble because we cannot plant a foot and pivot like you would in stand-up basketball. So we are allowed to carry the ball and dribble again in certain circumstances. Now, we do still have the same travel rule. However, it looks a little bit different. In stand-up basketball, you're allowed 2 steps before it's a travel, and then you have to pivot. In wheelchair basketball, it would be 2 pushes, or essentially 2 touches of the push wheel could be considered as the same as the steps. But then we are able to dribble again since we can't plant and pivot.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, it'd be great.
Absolutely.
Thanks. My friends, I've always maintained disability sport can have a profound impact on a person's life, especially when dealing with an acquired injury. A person's instinct might be to say, my life is over, there's nothing I can do, but being out there, part of a team, doing something high energy, high speed, can really be, to use a bad pun, a game changer. It can take a person from seeing their life being one of limited potential, to one where they're keeping active, keeping strong. And it's not just out on the field or on the court. Those skills are transferable. A person might find that if they do well in something like wheelchair basketball, they can take the strength and the speed of the game home with them. They become just stronger as a person. That's the right of everyone with a disability. No matter or you're dealing with a physical condition, or something like a mental health concern, there is always potential to succeed and to grow beyond not only our own expectations, but society's as well. I love hearing stories of adapted equipment, adapted games. I love it when people find a way to do what was once considered impossible. For the fact is, once you open those doors, you burn the gates behind you. Setting that precedent, proving something is possible, really does change the disability community. You can't maintain that something can't be done with the proof looking you right in the face. Truth of the matter is, disability is not, per se, a limitation. It is simply another way of thinking. Asking the question, how can I adapt the world to still be a part of it? How can I fully contribute? What can I do to change things so that I'm given equal inclusion, equal dignity, equal respect, which is ultimately what I think we're all seeking for? It's not a matter of lording one's talents over another. It's a question of using the skills we have to contribute to society, thereby adding to the puzzle that is this great world. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me You've earned it, folks. Well